Check, check. I could probably be a little louder.
Are we recording?
Welcome back to the Whatever Nevermind podcast. Joshua, you are officially the first repeat guest. How are you this evening?
I'm doing well, Getting to talk to you, always a good time. And, you know, we text often about football and other shenanigans. But so it's nice to see you through the power of the internet and always good to talk to you.
Yeah, I wasn't sure after this last Sunday's game if I was going to be able to make it. I've called in sick all week. I don't even have any sick days left because of all this COVID shutdown stuff. But, you know, that's just my squad needs me. You know what I mean? So I need to be. I need to take the game pretty hard. But at least you were able to eke out a W on the road there in the Mile High City.
Yeah, it was a tough one, man. It was not only was it, you know, a tough win. I guess there's a tough win, I guess you can do. But, you know, I'm on Eastern time. Mm-hmm. So the game wasn't over until like 1:45 in the morning. And I'm not as spry as I used to be about staying up all night. So yeah, normally about the time the game started is about the time I'm normally, you know, rolling into bed.
Did you manage to catch the whole thing or not?
Well, oh, absolutely. I watched the whole thing.
Live?
Yeah, live. Yeah. You know, someone said something about that at work. Like, why don't you just DVR it and watch it after work the next day? And I'm like, you can't DVR live sports. Like,
it never
just
works.
Not gonna happen. No. Like, even if I shut my phone off and everything else, I would see somebody somewhere that I haven't seen in 10 years. Be like, man, what about that Titans game last night, bro? And I'd be like, shut up.
Yeah, it's... you can't really. I mean, I remember trying to like. I used to work night shift, so I'd record like Monday night or Thursday night games, and on my VCR. And there wasn't a single fucking time that somebody that probably hadn't talked to me in 2 months at work came up and said, "Tough loss for the Vikes." Hey, thanks. You never. You know, I got married. You never fucking said a word about that.
I think it's worse, too, is I used to work with a guy that would, he would record University of Louisville basketball games, and he would watch them when he got off work, and I would always somehow hear the score, and it was even worse, like, knowing the outcome and not being able to say anything about it. You're just like, and I'm the type of person that, you know, if you've got a sunburn, I'm going to pat you on the back. You know, if you had someone die recently, I'm going to make a bad joke and not know that your loved one died. You know, like, I'm that guy. So so knowing the information and not being able to say it, I'll just be standing there like, they won by 7.
You know. Nice. You know, I'll tell you a true story. I used to work at a place called Schmidt Printing in Byron, Minnesota, and there was a guy who came to work all dressed up. And I made the joke, like, who died? And he's like, my aunt.
I was like, see, I didn't know. See, it happens to everybody.
Yeah. Is he fucking with me or am I just a dick? Hey, it turns out they weren't that close. But, well, let's get back to Whatever Nevermind. Coming in at number 13 on Rolling Stone's Greatest Grunge Albums of All Time is the first of three records from Nirvana, their debut record, Bleach. This was released on Sub Pop Records on June 15th, 1989, and produced by previous guest of the show here, Jack Endino. 11 tracks, or is it 12? Is it 11 or 12? Do you have it in front of you? For some reason, I think it's 12.
I thought I had like 13, but...
All right. Well, between 11 or more tracks, and according to Wikipedia, 37 minutes and 19 seconds. Now, it did not chart upon its original indie release because it wasn't a fucking indie release. And it had sold a pretty respectable 40,000 copies in North America before the release of Nevermind. Since that point, it's basically double platinum. And it is, of course, Sub Pop Records' best-selling album to date. And since nobody buys albums anymore, it's probably a record it will have forever. So, you know, I will mention that the last episode that just came out on whatever, never mind here, was the Alice in Chains record at 14 was Facelift. And from 14 to number one, 8 of the 14 records are Alice in Chains, Soundgarden, Pearl Jam, and Nirvana, the big four, if you will, of grunge. So, but Nirvana, they fill 3 of those slots, and today we're talking about Bleach. You would have been a little pup when this was released, and I didn't know anything about this record until Nirvana really blew up. Did you know much? I mean, I assume no.
When this was released, actually, I was at a record store, and the guy behind the counter was like, "You need to check this out, bro." And I was like, "I do." And then about a month later, they came through town, and I got to party with them, and So my knowing of Nirvana went back years and years. But no, I don't know. I didn't know them. I was 9 years old when this album came out, so yeah. I had not heard it.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder what the original pressing was, as far as the number of copies. I should say the band at this time, of course, has Kurt Cobain and Chris Novoselic, but it was recorded prior to Dave Grohl joining the band. So a guy named Chad Channing was the drummer du jour for this record, but Melvin's drummer Dale Crover appears on 3 tracks: Floyd the Barber, Paper Cuts, and Downer.
What are your sources, bro?
Largely Google, right. The internet. I was there for everything that I mentioned. I was at the recording of this record. I was the one who actually filled out the bill for the $606 or whatever it cost to do this. But we'll get into all that kind of stuff. How about this? You've heard the record before today?
Yes, many times.
Okay, is it a record that you own, go back to? Do you like? Where does it fall in Toomey's fandom?
Go back to, man, I don't go back to a lot of Nirvana to begin with, but yeah. I definitely went through some phases. I think we may have talked about it in the last episode where I kind of go through these phases where I was like reading everything about Kurt Cobain, getting into all the albums, listening to bootlegs and things like that. So yeah, I got into this pretty heavy, years later, probably in the mid 90s. But yeah, I until the last couple of days listening to it again, I hadn't listened to it in a very long time.
I've heard it enough in my life, but it's a record I would say I'm more avoided than anything. You know what I mean? I never bought it. I liked Nevermind for a little bit, but got sick of it pretty quick. And then once Nirvana came big, and almost anything about Nirvana just didn't click with me. I didn't like the way Kurt's face looked. I didn't like the left-handed guitar. I didn't like the super dry snark, even though it's basically who I am. just nothing about it. Even the logo, which we'll get into, was kind of an accident. That really didn't land with me. And even the band name Nirvana is just kind of like, well, was, you know, Utopia taken? It seemed kind of generic and not really thought out for a band that was being treated as basically the next Rolling Stones or Beatles or something like that. So getting back to it for this is basically something that was a bit eye opening, and then as we get into the songs, I'll save my final thoughts for it. But for the most part, I heard it plenty just by going to people's houses. Riding, being a passenger in a car in the 90s, you know what I mean? This was just a hard record to ignore. Going to record stores, that kind of stuff, it was going to be out there. It didn't get shit for radio play. Most of the songs that I remembered clearly were ones off of MTV Unplugged. So, the short review I'll give you leading into this, it's better than I remembered it. And I'll leave it at that, because this is not one that I have ranked very high on my list.
I think I can agree with that.
Well, the record opens up with a song that would probably be my answer if someone said, "What did you think of the Nirvana record Bleached in 1990? I probably would have said it blew. We'll be right back. What do you got
is
here
that,
for me, Toomey?
Cue the Aaron Camaro laugh. obviously, being a bass player, you can never go wrong with a bass intro. You know, this is kind of just a precursor to the entire album. A lot of the vocal lines going along with the guitar lines. There's not a lot of counter melodies and things like that with Kurt, especially on this album.
Right.
And then, you know, obviously in the solo section, you get a typical grunge solo, you know, that's not very flashy and maybe not even in tune. So I mean, overall, you know, this is just a, like I said, a precursor to the entire album.
Well, legend has it that it got kind of that low sound because Chris Novoselic accidentally tuned too far down and not realizing his bass was already at drop D, he dropped a drop C or something like that, and gave Blue its speaker-wrecking low end. So they recorded a bunch of tunes, but they decided to keep it for this one. For the most part, they thought it wasn't that good of an idea, so they didn't carry it on for beyond that. Anything they recorded, I guess they must not have kept, but... As far as what I thought, I don't think it's a good way to open a record. It didn't do it for me there. And I know when I talked to Bruce Pavitt, he actually mentioned having to resequence this record and how Kurt didn't really care for that. But he's like, you got to understand, you want to get people interested with your first three songs, otherwise you're dead. That said, I do think it's a pretty good song. And yeah, it's kind of the embryonic phase of Kurt developing his singing style and his songwriting. It's just a good example of what was to come, I guess. To me, sounds like, you know, something off an album before and a band kind of blew up. So what's our rating system today, Toomey? Do you have that ready for us?
Man, you know, I thought about this one. You know, last one we did was L7 with the bloody tampons. I mean, do you go shotguns? You know, do you go whatever? You know, so I'm going to play it safe and nice because I enjoy some Nirvana. So let's just go flowery dresses.
All right. How many flowery dresses are we giving Blue?
I will give it a 4.
I did too. Up next is my... esteemed co-host of the Cobras and Fire show's favorite title of any song ever, Floyd the Barber. True story that Loose Cannon did not know that Floyd the Barber was a reference to the character Floyd the Barber on the Andy Griffith Show, the Mayberry deal.
Excuse me?
Right, I do remember hearing that episode and rolling my eyes all the way to the back of my head when Lewis did not know who Floyd the Barber was.
Thanks.
But if there's a show on Amazon that nobody's watching, he's got plenty of quotes for you from that.
Nice one.
But
good old Elsie.
Elsie. Not, this is a... Sadly, this is not the Let's Pick on LC show. That'll be on a future episode. But Floyd the Barber. Elsie has no idea who this character was. I gave it a 2. I didn't really care for this too much. Getting into the song, kind of touching on what I just said, Gen Xers like Kurt loved taking mainstream culture and twisting it into unsettling, perverse shapes, and so it was with Floyd the Barber. This is apparently a fictional story of a fictional character, based on a fictional character that molests children, and then eventually the other show characters take turns dismembering his corpse, so...
Nice.
Anyway, I gave it a 2. What do you got? I'm sorry. I gave us 2 flower dresses.
Flowery dresses.
Flowery.
I love the intro. I love the outro. There's just some. That's very. It's almost like a juvenile first band. Like, let's do this, and then because you know the outro is the all three of them doing it, and then just the bass and the drums doing it, and then just the drums doing it, and then it's over. It's like that's like stuff that you would do in your like 13-year-old band, and there's something like maybe some juvenile charm about it. I don't know. But I also gave Floyd the Barber 4 flowery dresses.
Wow. All right. Well, you liked it a little more than I did. But yeah, whatever. So we got a 4 and a 2. The next song made some headlines recently when the singer from Puddle of Mud did one. I can't even believe this thing got released.
I need an easy friend. I deal with the head to hand. I deal. Thank you for this too. I deal. But you have a clue. Take it, then it's wild. You hang me out to dry. I can see you every night. Rain.
Yeah, it's funny because I was listening to it in the car today, and I was singing along with it, and I'm like, you know, this song really isn't that hard to sing.
Have a clue.
And so hearing it again, it's just like, or hearing his version, I don't know if they like tuned differently or they tuned up or they needed to tune down and he just couldn't get to that note. Because, I mean, homeboy from Puddle of Mud is not a terrible singer, but no, he did not have the range for the song. And it's pretty sad to say you don't have a range to do a Nirvana song.
If anything, it seems like this would be in his sweet spot. So it almost felt like a tuning thing.
Yeah.
Supposedly he's been sober for a few years, so my first gut reaction was, well, he's drunk or high or something, which can cause those kind of issues. But that song "Breed" seems like the perfect cover for them. I don't know if they've done it or not, but that seems like where I would go if Puddle of Mud called me up and said, "Baco, what song should we cover by Nirvana?" I would say "Breed."
You would just hang up.
Yeah. Breed, click. Oh, just hang up in general?
Yeah, just that click. You know, this is one of those songs, man, that, like, obviously the unplugged version is the more popular version. Everybody's heard it, and it was a single off of that.
Yeah.
But it just kind of goes back to, I think Kurt is a great songwriter. I think he had a knack for memorable, vocal lines and things like that. So just kind of hearing it this way, you know, you hear just kind of like a raw version of the song, and then they obviously make it acoustic and it gets popular later.
Yeah.
But yeah, it just kind of goes to show you, no matter how bad this album sounds, the essence of the album is really good.
I dislike almost everything on that unplugged record for whatever reason. It just nothing connects with me off of that. But the original studio version of the song, I think, is solid. Now, this was written, a lot of musicians who are songwriters have had to deal with this, where they write all these songs, and then one day their girlfriend's like, "When you gonna write a song for me, Kurt?" So apparently that was the inspiration behind this. And apparently there's some shitty lines in here, like, "I don't think you fit this shoe." So I think he's like, basically the song could have been called "I Think I'm Gonna End Things." What was your rating here for About a Girl?
I gave it a 4.
Yeah, for this version, I give it a 3.5. It would probably get a 1 or a 0 if we were doing the unplugged version. But
excuse me.
How many songs have Amy had you write for her?
I have written one song for my wife. Yes, she's never actually requested. Something that like expresses love for something. I'm not very good lyrically and melodically with that kind of stuff. It's more dark and anger and upset with, you know, the church. That kind of stuff is more my cup of tea. And not a lot of songs that women want to hear like that about themselves. Anyway, I've written about a bunch of exes. That's been fucking a gold mine.
Fuck you. Fuck you. Fuck you. Fuck you. Fuck you. Fuck you.
fuck you. Fuck you. Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
You fucking bitch.
Oh, fuck you. All right. Well, next up is track 4 on side 1. It's called School.
This kind of starts that whole another typical grunge thing to me is, you know, just repeating the same lines over and over again. You know, obviously hearing a song about no recess, that's a bummer. And then, you know, just another awful guitar solo. So,
yeah, he said that was a joke at first and then it turned out to be a really good song. And I'm like, no, it didn't. are your kids you have kids in school? Are they doing distance learning or are they in person?
The youngest one is doing online kindergarten, so that's pointless.
Are you playing this song the whole time?
Yes.
No recess.
You do not get
no
any
recess. So do they like leave the Zoom computer on while they take a nap? It's nap time.
No, it's just a lot of I mean, we have a work packet and you know, just do this stuff and then they kind of just meet for like half an hour and all the kids, you know, it's complete chaos. If you can imagine an entire kindergarten class on a Zoom with like 3 or 4 of them unmuted, and the first day I did it, I was like, this is insanity.
And next time, just hit record and release it as your next podcast.
I might do that.
Yeah, that's not a bad deal. School, yeah, I'm kind of with you. This song I thought it was kind of stupid. musically, though, I'm with Kurt a little bit here. I think it's actually kind of a fun song musically. I could probably push it to a 4, but let's go 3.5.
I'm going to surprise you with a 4 on this one.
Up next is Love Buzz. Would you believe? Love Buzz was an actual 45 they released, one of the first that Sub Pop ever put out at all. It was another song in here. What was the B-side to that? I had that. Love Buzz and Big Cheese, I think.
Big Cheese, yeah,
okay. Love Buzz and Big Cheese, one of the early releases from Sub Pop. So I believe this is one of the 3 songs Crover plays on. Is that right? I'm not sure who plays drums on Love Buzz. This might have been re-recorded for the record, but this is apparently something that Chris Novoselic brought to the table. I don't know. And then Kurt kind of liked it and kind of helped flesh out a tune from it.
Yeah, this is a shocking blue cover. And I went back and listened to the original today. And wow, it's pretty nuts. I never knew it was a cover until 10 minutes before we recorded. And I listened to it really quick.
Please don't deceive me when I hurt you. It just ain't the way you. Hear my love buzz. Can't you hear my
some of the, you know, the bass line and stuff is all there, but it's definitely not a rock song at all.
Something sort of tied to this song that I learned through the process of this. Now, Sub Pop was founded by Bruce Pavitt and a guy whose name, it turns out, is not Pwn Man. His name is Poneman, Jonathan Poneman. When I was talking to Jack and Dino, he mentioned his name, and I was like, a light bulb went off. It's like, because I've been reading all about him and all these things, getting, you know, research for this thing. It's like, I like the idea of, like, his last name being Pwn Man. But anyway,
he'd be a better name.
He played the demo for Jack and Dino, who produced the EP and this record. But as far as the song, it's got that cool kind of punk bass opening, and
yeah,
Kurt's vocal is actually pretty clean on this. This is a very punk tune, though. This is kind of more to the, this seems like very much the roots of what I anticipate this band would become.
Yeah, and this is kind of the Kiss fan in me as a younger kid was, you know, I always thought of Love Gun when I heard this song. Like, can you feel my love gun? Can you feel my love buzz? Yeah, and I do really enjoy Kurt's vocals on this, especially the, you know, the Queen of My Heart. He kind of says that a little crazy every once in a while, so I really enjoy this one.
What's the rating you got?
We'll give this one a 4.
I'll give it a 4 as well. And closet Kiss fan, Kurt Cobain.
I don't know if he was that closet about it. He was
kind of snarky any time it came up, though. You know, but that was pretty much I guess he was that way with everything, huh? So it was,
right.
All right. Up next, we have Paper Cuts.
I think might be the most controversial of all of them. Obviously, I think I love the Melvins intro. Very Melvins intro. The main guitar lines in this are very reminiscent of Seasons in the Abyss by Slayer. And then there's also an Alice in Chains aspect to this song for me. So, I mean, it's very... and this album would have came out before Seasons in the Abyss, so I might need to call Jeff Hanneman and see what's going on there.
How is he doing lately?
Sleeping.
You know, not so good, Paco.
Not so good.
That's going to come off kind of tasteless, but who cares? I had the same thing down. This very much opens up like a Melvins tune, and this, not by any coincidence, is one of the tunes that Dale Crover plays on. It has that big booming drum sound there right at the beginning. They apparently tried to re-record this with Chad Channing on drums and just never got the vibe, so they said, fuck it, keep the original drum track, and they recorded all the other stuff. There was apparently some inspiration of a story of a local family who had imprisoned their children in the basement, only opening the door to feed them and changed the newspapers that they put down there for them to poop on. So it sounds like urban legend, but, you know, Kurt, he liked to kind of spread that shit around a little bit. Maybe, like, he knew the guy was his dealer or something is the urban legend tied to that. But
Having worked in the foster care system and having worked around kids with issues, that's not as uncommon as you think.
Really?
Yeah, it's a mess, man.
Well, that definitely sounds like a goddamn mess. You would really hope that the foster care kids didn't end up with a drug dealer, but, you know.
Well, it's more where the foster kids come from.
Oh,
foster
sure.
Kids come from, yeah.
All right. Oh, that part I definitely would believe, but we took in a couple foster kids a couple times. My mom was a nurse and had some Christian duty to help out, but it was always weird. Looking back, maybe I would have been a little better foster brother if I had met my druthers. But back to Paper Cuts. I gave it a 3. How about you?
Also gave it a 4.
Oh, right on. I'm not quite sure you said also.
I don't know either. I think it's because I've given, if you're keeping track, I've given every song a 4 so far.
Oh, fair enough. Well, before we fast forward to the end of side 2 here and flip the cassette, there's a famous story, of course, about the amount of money that it cost to actually record this. The actual sum is $606.17, which is also the amount of money the record label didn't have. I actually had Bruce Pavitt on the show earlier. Let's listen to him tell this story. Well, speaking of not having a lot of money, the story of Bleach almost not getting financed, I think, is amazing. Do you want to share that? Well, I know it's been told a lot, but...
Well, it is a ridiculous story, you know, when the soon-to-be world's biggest band, which we did not fully realize at the time, they're like, we got to get in the studio, we got to get in the studio. And Kurt calls me up, he says, we got to get in the reciprocal, we're tired of waiting. And I said, I'll be honest with you, we don't have any cash. And I said, do you think you could front the money for the recording? In other words, can you loan me the money so I can give it back to you? And he basically hung up on me. But they did go in the studio, and it was financed by Jason Everman, who didn't actually play on the recording. I think what happened was they went in, the bill was owed, and Jason Everman wound up paying it, even though he wasn't on the recording. But that $608 recording translated into 2 million sales. So kind of it's a profound lesson there as far as understanding that if you create something that's really cool, you don't have to spend a lot of money.
Well, and I assume when they went to Geffen, was there had to be some kind of buyout with you guys, or were they not under any contract?
There was a very famous contract. They were literally the only band on our label that was signed because they insisted that they get a contract. We Xeroxed one from a book in a library and used a little whiteout, changed a few things around. They signed the contract, and because they signed this contract that they insisted on having, we wound up getting points on a number of different records. And we wound up owning Bleach and so forth. So, I don't know. It kind of worked out for everybody.
But we also, and before we get into some of these other facts here, I would like to mention that Jack and Dino, who produced the record, was on the show. And before we get too far in here, I'll just quickly play what his thoughts were on the recording of this band. I'll tell you this. Coming at number 13 on the list is probably a band you get asked about the most. Nirvana, you did the Bleach album.
Sure.
Is it true you did that for a flat fee of about $600?
Well, it was a flat fee. We were charging hourly at the time, but I think the studio was only like $12 an hour or something.
Okay.
But that's what it came to. It was like something like $606 and some change. The number has been, I know Michael Azard imprinted the number in his book. I don't remember the precise number. It was $606 and something. That was when, you know, I went back and looked at the studio lock sheets and just added the fees up, and that's what I came up with. It was a pretty quick one. It was 8-track, you know, mm-hmm. but I knew they were a brilliant band.
Could you kind of see what they were going to become, or is that just too hard to predict?
It was hard to predict. I didn't know they were going to become I didn't know the songwriting was going to become as poppy as it did. And I say that term very loosely.
Mm-hmm.
I knew they were a brilliant band. The thing is, I record a lot of bands that I think are brilliant bands. That doesn't mean the rest of the world will agree.
I can relate to that.
Know, yeah, who knew? You know, I mean, what happened was certainly not to the degree that I would have expected.
How long did it take to record?
Something. I mean, in total studio time, it was something like 30 hours.
Oh, I guess we could do the math, huh? You said $12 an hour.
Something like that. Yeah, I don't know if that math works out, actually, because I was always a little bit pretty flexible about it, what hours I actually wrote on the log.
Sure.
It was something like that. I mean, it was, you know, I remember working it out one time. It was 30-something.
So I have some facts if you'd like to kind of get into it here a little bit.
Okay.
All right, well, these are things that, according to, I think, Loudwire, you should know, or you probably don't know unless you're a super diehard. Well, of course, we know that Nevermind broke the band, but a lot of Seattle scene purists consider Bleach to really be the only grunge album they did. What are your thoughts on that? Because I'll tell you straight up, personally, I don't think their sound changed enough from this album to two records later to really say, oh, this was grunge, everything else was something else. It was more polished, more produced, with the bigger budgets, but to me, if this is grunge, the other two records are grunge.
I agree with you 100% on that one. And it just kind of goes back to this album just sounds like shit.
Sorry, Jack.
You know, it goes on to be much more better. It goes on to be better produced later on, but you still have the makings of Nirvana songs here. You have Kurt's writing style. You have Kurt's vocal style, guitar style. Everything's here that was on Nevermind. It's just poorly recorded.
Sure. Yeah, that's how I feel about it, too. I mean, the songwriting's a little better. Like, he got more practice and started writing better songs. But the whole vibe is there. You can see the growth pattern easily. So,
but I will say, in defense of this album sounding bad, I mean, for $600, this sounds like a masterpiece.
Oh, yeah,
and for how much time they had, for the equipment they probably had, everything that they had to work with, I think they made the best of. And I've definitely recorded, you know, albums in the past and probably spent $600 and they didn't sound like this. So easily. I'm not trying to shit on it too bad. So
no, I'll flat out say it. The first three records that Jesus Chrysler did all cost in that range between $600 and $800. Yeah. And none of them sound as good as this record. It shows you the importance of having someone who kind of knows how to work the knobs and record a raw track. And Jack and Dino, for what it's worth, I mean, he seemed to really get at least the clean audio. So if when you do have time to go back and do a proper remix, remaster, you're not dealing with these oversaturated tracks that have a lot of effects that you can't take off, that kind of deal.
Yeah. Before you dive too far into the facts, I did want to bring up Jason Everman here.
Oh, sure.
It seems like he was in the band for a minute. He's obviously on the cover of the album, credited as a guitarist on the album, but didn't play. And, you know, he did some touring for this thing. But I wonder how much the fact that he had the $606.17 got him in the band, you know, like.
Oh, they absolutely said it because he doesn't play on the record. And he's credited as a guitar player. Do you think he ever got like a solid, like, even like, hey, here's $1,000, bro. Thanks for, you know, this thing went double platinum, man.
Right. Yeah, you got to wonder about all this stuff because even, you know, even the people, the producer and everything else that they, you know, they got the $600, the studio got the $600, but, you know, obviously at the end of the day, you know, this thing sold 2 million albums.
Yeah.
You always wonder about the producers and things like that if they took points, and you know, probably don't even think about taking points
not
on something
level.
That cost you $600 back in the day. But
no, if anything, Jack and Dino says like that he probably actually didn't bill him for his complete time. He probably rounded down a little bit, and that was all he got was that flat fee.
But I think Jason Everman went on to play on a couple of things, maybe. So that's been re-released over the years. So I'm sure he gets a little chunk of cash. But I mean, also his resume. If you look him up on Wikipedia, he was also in a band called Mind Funk, which I've heard of. He was also in Soundgarden for a half a second, playing bass, and then in a band called Old, which is you know, another band that's out there. And you know, now he's been in the military and doing all this other crazy stuff. So probably lived a very cool life. You know, getting to say that he was in Nirvana. I wonder how, you know, how many chicks he picked up in a bar saying, you know, that album cover Bleach, that's me. But
Well, he was a hard ass in the military too. I mean, is he still in? I'm not sure, but he was a Green Beret, Special Forces.
Yeah.
So he probably had, I mean, there's the trifecta. I'm fucking Green Beret, Special Forces, and I was in fucking Nirvana. I financed the entire first record out of my own pocket, bitch.
Yeah, you got to think at some point somebody wrote him a check and was just like, "Here you go, man. We appreciate everything you've done."
Well, he wasn't invited to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame ceremony, and I believe Chad Channing was. So I don't know if there was just like some kind of distance there, or the fact that Dave Grohl never knew him. I don't know, but and you know, he didn't really play on anything, so I get why the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame might not bring him in, especially if they're not going to include Chad Channing, but. man, just, I mean, because Sub Pop, like, a drunken Chris Novoselic demanded that they make a record, that they give them a contract, an official binding contract. Because up to that point, everything they'd done has just been like kind of like a handshake deals with all the bands they did. If they didn't do that, Sub Pop probably would have went out of business. They could have, you know, Nirvana could have just taken the Bleach record with them, and then, you know, the record company, I think it was DGC they signed with, they could have just re-released it and kept all the money, but they got a big old fat pile of cash to kind of keep things going there at Sub Pop, and it's probably why Bruce Pavitt has this giant little hidden area in Washington that he lives on.
Yeah, and the very similar to, you know, Metallica and Megaforce.
Yeah,
you know, where they go on to, you know, they go on to Elektra, and the Megaforce name is on the early albums.
Yeah,
you know, where you would buy this album on Geffen, and then you would see Sub Pop on there. Oh, what's Sub Pop? I'm gonna go check it out. Oh, they have all these other, you know, albums. Let's check out those albums too. So very similar story there.
Yeah, but yeah, it's cool talking about Jason Everman, because like you said, his path is very, I don't know, ungrunge post his music career, you know. So, but back to some other stuff here. Novoselic said that when they were touring they had just a shitty van they would drive around, like most bands can relate to, leading up to recording this, and they had a cassette that they had dubbed. On one side was a Smithereens record, and the other side a Celtic Frost. Now, I found this story in several different sources, but that's still. That seems a little too cute. It's like, oh, yeah, this is what we are influenced by, the Smithereens and Celtic Frost. You know, it's like, who would do that? We're so grungy. What are you thinking there? You think that they literally listened nonstop to the Smithereens and Celtic Frost?
I can see that. I mean, you know, depending on who dubbed the cassette, and maybe that's the only cassette in the van. And
now that part I can relate to, where you're the long road trip and there's not a lot to listen to. Yeah, especially when money's tight, you know.
Oh yeah, that's definitely, you know, I've definitely been on some tours where we didn't have very many things in the van, and I've heard the same album over and over, you know, to where you want to get up and throw the CD out the interstate. But yeah, it was, it could have happened.
All right, and then as far as the lyrics, apparently, and then Kurt told this in many different sources, so this is probably pretty legit. He just said he really wasn't at the stage where he was thinking about them a lot, so he really didn't care that much until he got close to where he had to write something down that was going to be committed to it, and he would just kind of wrap it up there shortly before, like the night before they were going to record it or something like that. And it kind of comes off like that.
Yeah, not like I said, the lyrics are very, you know, samey over and over, repeated lyrics. And, you know, you get a cool scream over your thing, and you're not really worried about the lyrics. And, you know, the lyrics were not ever a huge thing of grunge to me. You know, there weren't a lot of epic tunes about, you know, dragons or anything with grunge.
And what about the title Bleach? That supposedly was inspired by an AIDS prevention poster geared towards drug addicts with needles. Something in the sign said it advised heroin users basically to bleach their needles prior to shooting smack. That seems like that's a very Seattle grungy kind of story to hear. And the working title was apparently Too Many Humans. That's not an LC joke. I don't have them on here too. That's apparently what they were going to call it, was Too Many Humans.
Well, that's not a bad. Either one works, you know, with Nirvana and Bleach and Nevermind, and you know, not a very huge, probably not a lot of time put into the album titles themselves.
Yeah, and with no input from the band, the whoever designed the album cover just picked that logo. I think it's Onyx is what it said here, but and then the band just kept it as basically their logo going forward. So that actually worked out for them, I suppose, if you like it anyway. What do you think about the album cover? Do you like it?
Yeah, I mean, it's always been a very cool kind of indie album cover, and I'm guessing you in your day-to-day job, you know, you look at things like fonts and album title and album logos and stuff, and I know that their logo's a little offset, so it probably just irks your
there's an artistic side to me, though. I understand it. That would bother LC more than me. He likes things to be you know, A plus B equals C. This is centered perfectly, cropped properly. I'd give the album cover 5 flowery dresses. I think it's a fabulous. I mean, especially when you consider, again, all this is done so cheap and everything is, it's like amazing how well it turned out. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, that obviously always goes back to the songs. A good song is a good song, and there's a lot of good songs on this album.
Yeah. The photo was a picture of the four of them performing, because Everman did actually play. We almost made it sound like he didn't ever do anything with the band. He toured and played with them for some time. He just didn't play on this record. But Cobain's girlfriend took the picture, probably with one of those goddamn disposable cameras, because everything had to be super fucking cheap and turn out perfect. But and then, yeah, it was inverted for the name. But I give it high marks.
Very good album. And the very good album cover. And the length, 37 minutes, 19 seconds. I always like that, too.
Yeah.
Short and sweet.
Yeah, let's get to it. All right, well, let's get back to the record then. Side 2 of the cassette. You flipped her over, dropped her in the shitty van, and you've been listening to this thing nonstop. This, Celtic Frost and the Smithereens. It opens up with Negative Creep. Kick it to you here. Negative Creep was basically, in the words of Kurt, just one big Rush job. He calls the riff the work of a Neanderthal magic. It's a distorted two-note jackhammer, and I think that's a pretty fair description. Kurt, this is one of the songs that I came across that he basically said, I didn't care about lyrics at the time. He was talking about himself when he said Negative Creep, which would explain why it says I'm in the first possessive, a Negative Creep. Anyway, I like the song. I tried to find my rating. This one I had a 3.5 on, too.
This is one where the kind of the androgyny of grunge kind of comes out a little bit with the Daddy's Little Girl and A Girl No More.
Yeah.
You know, it's very anti-jock. You know, we're gonna talk about...
Yeah, very much.
We're going to talk about, you know, wearing dresses and you know, calling ourselves little girls and things like that. And so, and then also love the screams in this one. This is where it's, you know, he's obviously not textbook screaming. He's just emotionally screaming. So overall, man, great song. And I love the riff.
And what was your rating?
I gave it a 4.
All right. I love them 4s. Never play craps with Toomey. He always rolls a 4. Well, the next track, Scoff, I just wrote down that I think the drums are horrible.
Vocal pattern when he's saying the give me back part, he has a very cool little give me back, not give me back, not give me back, just kind of cool, just that, you know, obviously once again just repeating, but it was a very cool thing. And then I'm along for the ride at this point.
It seems like there's several examples on this record where it's like once he gets the hook, he stops. He's like, that's all we need. Yeah, just do it 20 more times.
Yeah, he's just one of those dudes that, you know, we're a lot of vocalists, and I'm assuming you do the same, where you'll kind of have more of a scat vocal of just sounds, and then you're going to go back and write lyrics to those sounds, and he just kept the sounds.
Yeah. Right? Well, it's the melody. That's what you're trying to establish, but... Well, I gave it 3 flowery dresses. Did you give your rating on this one?
I have not, but I gave it a 4.
All right. Up next is Swap Meet. hanging out at swap meets and barking chainsaws. This is somebody's write up here on, I think it was Loudwire. There's sympathy and empathy in Kurt's lyrics, but precious little affection. Kurt would later go on to say the whole mentality is based on junk, grease, dirt, and poverty. I like the song. It's a really fun riff. To me, this is like the drums weren't captured as clean as some of the other ones, which is okay, because I like going back to early records by bands and kind of hearing the progression from like where they were to where they got to. So if you're okay letting a band not sound perfect and let a record, you know, grow, let a band grow and develop, this is a great tune, I think.
Honestly, this song is kind of funny, because you think a song about a swap meet, or entitled Swap Meet, is not actually going to be about a swap meet, but then you listen to the lyrics and you're like, wait a minute, this song is actually about going to a swap meet. So,
well, who's that guy that kind of more current douchebag? Macklemore, he's got a song called Thrift Store. That's all about going to the thrift store. I got $20, that's all I got. Thrift store.
But so I love a good swap meet.
You don't want to talk about Macklemore?
I also love a good thrift shop.
Okay, yeah, I did too. Especially as a youngster, I loved swap meets. But now that it's just kind of, they kind of turned into more antique farms where the everybody thinks everything they have is worth way more than it is, and I end up buying nothing. But no, I like a good swap meet.
I like a good dirty swap meet. You know, I like a good yard sale.
If the DVDs aren't bootleg, that's not my kind of swap meet. I want the bootleg, the greasy shit.
I always carry around a picture of Aaron Camaro, and I'm like, has this guy been here yet? And they're like, yeah. And I'm like, well, fuck. And then I leave.
They're like, he's right there. And then all of a sudden you're... he's looking at fucking wrestling dolls and...
finding CDs for Aaron's cutout bin.
Oh, yeah. No doubt. Future episode. This is great. I got to buy 2,000 of these to get 6 that I can fucking put on the show, but...
Aaron Camaro is a national treasure.
Absolutely. The only cheesehead in my life. Well, swap meet, what did you rate it?
I'm not going to ruin it for you, but I gave this one a 3.
Changing it up there, Mr. Toomey. All right. Well, the next track sounds like the title of an Adam Sandler movie. It's called Mr. Mustache.
The only thing I have written down is that I am proud of eating cows.
Yeah, this is was Kurt a vegetarian?
You know, there's no telling with him. Yeah,
I mean, is there meat in heroin?
Well, I will say, I mean, he admits in the song.
There's no beef-based heroin?
Well, I mean, I think one of the things you cut heroin down with is a knife, beef broth.
Yeah, so. Beef bullion. You gotta cut your meth with beef bullion.
Yeah, I mean, that's the best meth, is cut with beef bullion.
That's the upper Olympia area of Washington way.
Oh, yeah. Really, it's almost like in Canada.
Yeah.
In this song
the
title, lumber, I
the lumberjack
of,
way.
I kept thinking of Vinnie Vincent and his mean Mr. Mustard comment.
So
if we just had a mean Mr. Mustache.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, this is a cheap shot at hipsters, which is weird because he became basically the poster child for hipsters. Or titular hillbillies was another phrase that came up across researching this song. This is a punk tune, though, just straight up punk. I dig that. I think that's kind of what they do best. If I'm listening to Nirvana, I want kind of that rough edge stuff. This is a 4 for me.
That's funny, because I actually gave this one 2.5.
Yeah, we definitely like this record for different reasons. All right, now the official release ends with a track called Sifting. Now, this is a slow, acrid grind of Bleach. Never mind.
Try that again. You know, it's a good closing track, very Melvin sounding. Really like the chorus a lot. And yeah, just as an overall album, this is a great ending. It's 5.5 minutes long. It's a little bit longer than most Nirvana songs. So it's just kind of, you know, it's there for you. And and they definitely wear their Melvin's influences on their sleeves, not only on this song, but on the entire album.
You know, but it is odd, though, that the only two songs that you picked up, you mentioned the Melvins, were the same two that I wrote Melvins down on. So apparently it's clear if you're a fan of, or if you're familiar with the Melvins anyway. I think this is one of the strongest vocals on the record as far as, like, the recording. His voice sounds really strong on this track. Not to criticize the rest of it, I'm just saying it really pops here. I agree. This is a really good closer. As much as I really didn't care for Blue as an opener, if I listen to this record from beginning to end, like I have a few times for the last week, this is a good progression. I like the way it wraps up here. I gave it a 4.
I give it a 3.5.
There is a deluxe edition out that had two more tracks on it. Did you do any research on that, on either Big Cheese or Downer?
No.
I didn't either. I stuck to, like, I'm stuck to basically... you know, the format I established initially, that we're reviewing basically the original release. So I know Big Cheese was the side two of the single for Love Buzz, but it's out there if you want to check it out, people. They were recorded around the same time. Now, Big Cheese also features Downer features Dale Crover on drums. So if you want to check him out, go ahead. In the deluxe edition that was supervised by producer Jack Endino, these are included. There's also like a live concert from this time on there, and there's a there's a Next Level Deluxe that has a DVD of a show, that kind of stuff. So for your diehard Nirvana fans, you probably already got it and seen it. So I'm probably not doing a whole lot there, but I always give the guest the final thoughts. So I will put mine out right now. We already touched on my opening line here. I can't believe how good this record sounds for $600. Like I said, I did three albums myself for a budget of between $700 and $800. I don't remember exactly how much. It just shows you how important it is to record in a studio where they may not have the best equipment, but they know how to use it, that kind of thing. Our first record was recorded on the drums were recorded on Kelly Keegi of Night Ranger's drum set, which was a $15,000 DW kit. With mics, it was pre-mic, so you basically just plug cables into the side. The thing was professionally set up for recording. So even with that benefit, the drums don't sound as good as Jack got out of this, which I got to believe is a much shittier drum kit. Maybe a better player. I don't know. Sorry, Shags. it still has that raw indie sound. It's not a polished record by any means. If I liked Nirvana more, this record would probably rank much higher for me on this list, but as this was a record I never bought, I heard it more just hanging out with people or just being at a record store that was playing it. I just never really connected with it, and even going back and listening to it, while I like it probably more than I thought I did, I really don't care for it that much. I'm not looking forward to going back to it. But I will concede it's a great precursor. If you like Nirvana, this is a perfect... they do a really nice progression there. This record, Nevermind, and then into In Utero. But that said, this slides all the way from 14 on my list to number 24.
Excuse me?
Wow.
I only have one record ranked lower in this, and if anybody's been keeping score at home, they know we haven't got to it on the list yet, so that means it's ahead. I will spoil this. It's not a Nirvana record, so this is my lowest ranked Nirvana record.
I mean, I've kind of said it a few times over our discussion here about it being, you know, it sounds terrible, but again, $600, you know,
sounds
whatever.
Sounds great for $600.
Yeah, that sounds great for $600, but, you know, so the songs are there, the vocals are there, the performances are there, everything's there that they carried on over to Nevermind and then changed the entire landscape. For 1989, I mean, this is sounds very bizarre for 1989. So this actually moved up in my rankings from, 13 in the normal
13,
rankings?
13, yep.
I threw it up to number 8.
Wow. Nice one. All right.
So.
Which is why you're probably the guest for the show, for this episode. But I think I said this came in at 14. I have misspoke. This is number 13. And yeah, it goes down to 24 on my personal list. But so you have it all the way up at number 8. That's pretty solid. You're not planned to be back for the other Nirvana records. Do you like them better than this one? Or how would you rank it? If just rank those three albums for me.
Probably in reverse. I would probably say In Utero, Nevermind, and then this one.
Okay, so in the order they were released, basically, from worst to first. Did I say that right?
In Utero, the best. Nevermind, okay. Second. There we go. Bleach, third. Yeah. So that's
what about Incesticide?
You know, I did have that one too. So that one, that's a 2B.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. Well. Always love talking to you, Josh. The Tennessee Titans are my favorite AFC team, pretty much only because I'm talking to you right now. If you were off camera and Sinzak was there, I'd be the Chiefs. And, you know, I would just basically kowtow to whoever sat in front of me unless they were a fucking cheesehead or a Cowboy fan. But,
likewise.
it's always fun talking football with you. Hey, by the way, I should ask you, were you surprised that how calm it was talking to me after the Viking game last Sunday? Considering how it went, did I come off unfazed or was I in shock?
I feel like you were. I thought you might have just been drunk, and you changed the subject mighty quick. Started making fun of the Saints coach, and so
that
I
motherfucker pretends to chew gum. Him and Pete Carroll, those guys who chews gum for 3 hours all the time. You never see him spit it out. You never see him. 10 minutes without gum? Nope. Always. They're fucking fake. They think it makes them look like badasses.
Maybe with his face mask, he just has extra pieces of gum in his face mask that he can swap out.
Oh, man. But, the people do love it when we talk sports. But what do you got going on in the world of podcasting right now? Your fifth anniversary just popped. That's a pretty big deal. I mean, you're closing in on 8,000 episodes of the mm-hmm. Talk to Me podcast. What else is going on?
As of this recording, I have started a side podcast. I take all of my cues from Baco, and I have to do a side cast. So I'm doing a Pantera show entitled Drag the Waters, where I'm finding all of the tertiary characters of the Pantera
Ooh.
Universe and bringing them in. And
tertiary.
You like that?
That's and big for Louisville.
Well, that's my Tennessee education.
I'm sorry,
education
Louisville.
Louisville. So I'm bringing in all those people, man. I've been tracking down, you know, producers and engineers and mixers and interviewed Terry Glaze, the original Ooh. Vocalist of Pantera. I've got
he can't be too busy these days.
And
he'll never listen
the
to
guy
this show.
What's his name? Mark Eglin, the guy that co-wrote the Rex Brown book.
Oh, nice.
Got him on.
Downing too, I think.
Yes, he did. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, a few other people in the works. So as of right now, I've got a few cool episodes coming up with that or out, depending on how, you know, a month or two from recording this comes out. So it's been a lot of fun just, you know, looking at the records and seeing who produced, mixed. And plus with Pantera too, they put out so many home videos that you kind of got to know the crew
yeah.
and the tour manager and everything else. So a lot of those guys are, if you're a true diehard fan, were as popular as the band itself.
I think those videos might have been the first time I saw male nudity not in a porno.
Yeah! Yeah!
Well, there you go.
I got to tell you, though, that your podcast theme is probably the least shocking thing I've ever heard you say. And you're not really a controversial guy. So, but you're also a great podcaster, so I guarantee it's going
to
be good.
Well, yeah, it's basically just talk to me, but just changed a name.
Yeah, same logo.
Because, I mean,
even.
I've already had, like, you know, I've had Bobby Tongs, who was a kind of a character with the Pantera guys, Rita, who was Dime's longtime girlfriend, and then obviously Phil Anselmo's been on a couple times. So, I mean, it's pretty much just talk to me under a different name.
I forgot that because I until you brought it up the other day. I have the Kindle version of Rex's book, and I'm probably about a third of the way through it. But I got it when it came out, and I read everything I read basically on a, I can't remember where I was flying, Arizona or something like that. So I really got to fucking open that sucker up. This happens all the time with, especially with Kindle books. Like, yeah. I'm interviewing Michael Sweet again. Well, let me see if I can finish his book this time. I'm about halfway through.
Did you ever finish that Ron Keel book?
Nice.
I did finish the Ron Keel book after he gave it to me, the cheap ass.
Nice.
But that would make me the cheap ass. But so I assume that's going to be out on the Talk To Me feed, or is it going to be kind of its own thing?
I'm going back and forth. I think I'm going to put it out on its own feed.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, good luck with that. I look forward to listening to it. Of course, by the time people are hearing this, I've probably already digested every episode that you've had out. So, but yeah, you do a good products, and your passion for Pantera is obviously legit. You're my go-to guy. So I'm looking forward to hearing it.
I appreciate it, man. I can't wait for everybody to hear it. I can't wait for myself to hear it, because some of the interviews aren't done yet. So it's going to be a lot of fun doing it. And yeah, just once again, thanks for having me on. Always a blast to come on this show and the Cobras and Fire podcast and everything else in the Decibel Geek podcast network world.
We stopped saying that all about a year ago, I think. Yeah, and if Chris Sinzak wasn't, only because Toomey gave me shit about it weekly.
I liked it, though. Yeah,
no, I'm just kidding. Well, thanks for coming on and talking about the number 13 record on the list here, Bleach from Nirvana, their debut album. You want to wrap this up?
Whatever, man.
All right, never mind. Cooking dinner, cause my kids don't care. I'm a man, but I can still cook dinner, even though I'm a man. Ow. Here's your corn, here's your peas, here's your chicken, here's some weed. Oh, wait, not good to give kids weed. I wrote a Nirvana-inspired Toomey's Cooking Dinner song while you were gone. It'll probably be the Easter egg.
Chicken enchiladas.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.